Today's episode special guest is George Nolley. George Nolley served as a pilot in the United States Air Force, flying 315 combat missions on two successive tours of duty in Vietnam, earning 3 Distinguished Flying Crosses and 24 Air Medals, flying O-2A and F-4 Phantom aircraft. He was the last Air Force pilot to complete 100 missions over North Vietnam. While in the Air Force, George received the Tactical Air Command Instructor Pilot of the Year award. Following his Air Force duty, he hired on with United Airlines and rose to the position of Boeing 777 check captain. He also served as a Federal Flight Deck Officer. After his retirement from United, George accepted a position as a Boeing 777 captain with Jet Airways, operating through Europe, Asia, and the Middle East. He now flies instructs on the Boeing 777 and 787. He is the author of the Humphreys novel series and the host of the Ready for Takeoff podcast. Here is a quick highlight of this episode.
I'm using the Starlight scope and I'm looking around and I see two white lights coming. They're kind of stationary, very close to below the airplane. Two white lights, and they're stationary, not moving much, but they're kind of getting brighter and moving a little further apart. And I said to him, I said, I got two lights on the ground here, but they're moving slightly apart. And he says, no, it's AAA. And he banks the airplane hard left. And just as he banks hard left, I see those tracers go by the right wingtip, and I could hear them as they went by, because the window's open, and the O2 we flew with the window open.
And now, without any further ado, George Nolley. George, welcome to the 90s podcast. It's a pleasure, and I'm honored to having you here.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I'm honored to be with you.
Yeah, thanks a lot. George, first thing first, where do you come from and where did you grow up?
I grew up in Wilmington, Delaware. Delaware is the second smallest state in the United States. And in fact, there's only one city in the entire state, and that's Wilmington. So I grew up in Wilmington, Delaware.
That's where you fell in love with aviation?
That's right. You know, my father had a J-3 Cub when I was 2 years old. And he took my brother and myself up on airplane rides. And then he sold the Cub when I was about 4 years old. But I always was interested in aviation. You know, the funny thing is, when he took me up on rides when I was 2 years old, I was terrified. I was screaming my head off. But then I got more interested in aviation. And I remember I used to ride my bike over to a grass strip, a little airport called the DuPont Airfield near our house, and I'd watch the airplanes take off and land. And finally, when I was 10 years old for my birthday, my dad rented an airplane and took me up for a flight for my birthday. And I was just mesmerized by aviation, and I loved it.
Yeah. Did you continue to fly in general aviation later on?
Well, my father was killed when I was 15 years old, and I think I gravitated toward aviation just to have a part of him in my life. And so I started, when I was maybe 16 years old, I started reading everything I could, all the books in the library. I would devour all the books about aviation. And I started taking flying lessons when I was 17. And back then, now you're not going to believe this, but it cost a total of $10 an hour with an instructor to learn to fly in a Piper Cub. So I was about 8 hours into my flight training in a Piper PA-11 Super Cub, a PA-18, PA-18 Super Cub, and I was on my way. I was getting very close to solo, very close to solo, and I was on my way home from the airport, driving home, and a drunk driver hit my car from behind, and I had a neck injury. And I had to wear a brace on my neck for 9 months. So I couldn't turn my head to look to clear for traffic or anything. So the instructor wouldn't let me solo. So I had to wait a long time before I was able to move my neck around. And finally, I went to a different I was in the university then at the University of Delaware. And I went to a little grass strip 5 miles away from the university and rented a PA-11, which is a Piper J3 that you can solo from the front seat. And I got a few lessons with him, and then he soloed me. So I was able to finally solo in a PA-11.
Yeah, very nice to be able to fly one of those aircraft. We have a couple of G3 in France, and it's a tremendous aircraft.
Really? Yes.
Just coming back on your father, he was a pilot as well?
Oh, yes. He was not a professional pilot, but he had a commercial license and an instrument rating. And he was in the Air Force on active duty during World War II, but it was called the Army Air Corps then. But he was not a pilot. He was an engineer. So he never pursued flying professionally after the war.
That what led you to go to the military, your father career in the military?
That was it. I went to the University of Delaware, which is a civilian school, for 1 year. And then I was accepted into the United States Air Force Academy. So I attended the Air Force Academy for 4 years, and I was commissioned as a second lieutenant. And then I went to Air Force pilot training, which was a 13-month program where we'd start flying in the T-41, which is a Cessna 172. And then we went to the T-37, which is a jet aircraft, a twin-engine jet. And then we went to the T-37, which is a T-38, which is a supersonic twin-engine jet.
Yeah, okay. Then after your flight training in the military, you were assigned. It was in the middle of the Vietnam War.
That's right. So I did well in pilot training. The way you are assigned airplanes is based on your graduation order. So I was fairly high up in my class, so I knew I would get whatever I wanted. And I knew that I would get to fly a fighter, and there's a war going on, so I'd go to Vietnam flying a fighter. But it turned out there were no fighters available when my class graduated, none. So
yeah,
the only options were to fly B-52s or C-130s or C-135s or something like that. But they had these two airplanes on the list that nobody had ever heard of. One was called the O-2A, and the other was called the OV-10. And nobody had ever heard of them. I went to the library to look up those airplanes, and they weren't even in any of the books that talked about worldwide airplanes. So I went to one of the instructors who had just come back from Vietnam, and I thought maybe he might know something. And I asked him, what's the difference between an O-2A and an OV-10? And he said, well, they're replacing the O-1. You're going to be a forward air controller if you go there. He says they're basically the same airplane. So I chose, and by the way, on that assignment list, it said, if you volunteer to go to Vietnam in either of these airplanes, you'll get your choice of assignments afterwards. So I figure, okay, I'll go fly either the O-2A or the OV-10, and then I'll get to fly a fighter. So put down that I want to go in the O-2A, and that's what I got. So I went, I became a forward air controller.
Yeah, it was a good bet. Can you describe the tactical environment of the Vietnam War at that time, especially flying as a forward air controller?
Yes. So, you know, it was really two different wars for forward air controllers. The people who were flying in Vietnam, working with the Vietnamese soldiers or the American soldiers, supporting them, they were in Vietnam, and they would have to coordinate with the soldiers they're supporting before they could use any of their munitions. But I was assigned to the out-of-country mission, which is over Laos. So we did not need to get any coordination done. If we found the target, we could attack it. All of Laos was considered a free fire zone because that's where the Ho Chi Minh Trail was, where the bad guys, the North Vietnamese, were bringing war material down to attack South Vietnam. The Ho Chi Minh Trail was a very rudimentary dirt road, series of roads in Laos. And so we would patrol over the Ho Chi Minh Trail in Laos. And if we found the target, we would call the airborne command post and get them to assign us some fighters. And then we would attack the target. And I got to tell you, it was a great job. Here I was a first lieutenant, and I would be the on-scene battlefield commander. I would pick the target, decide what the run-in line is going to be, decide what munitions to put on the target. If I had more than one set of fighters, I would decide what order to put the fighters in on the target. It was really a great job. I wasn't enjoying it very much because I wanted to be one of those fighters that I was controlling. But in retrospect, it was a wonderful assignment.
Yeah, it was a kind of mission commander being a first lieutenant.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, that's a great, great opportunity. Even if you don't enjoy it at the moment of your assignment, you just enjoy it afterwards. You know, I think a lot about you guys that have done the Vietnam War because I'm flying a lot over it. Cambodia, Laos, and Vietnam, and reaching around Da Nang and all that stuff. And as well, I'm thinking about the French Air Force that went there. I always say to myself that it's tremendous that this is a kind of peaceful country now. And a couple of decades ago, it was complete war actions over it.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I remember when I first got there, Lieutenant Colonel, who was our boss, squadron commander, said, you know, someday the war will be over and people are going to make a lot of money taking tourists up and down the coast here because this is a gorgeous country. And they are right now. They are.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure you did some overflights over this area and I'm sure you thought about that.
Absolutely.
And then afterwards, after your O2 assignment, you were moved to the F4 Phantoms.
Well, it didn't work out the way the Air Force promised. The Air Force had told me that I'd get my choice of airplanes after my volunteering for my first tour in Vietnam. But there's this thing called the needs of the service. And they said, well, we need you to be in a B-52. I did not want to go to a B-52. First of all, I would not be an aircraft commander. I would be a co-pilot. And here I was the battlefield commander as a lieutenant, and now I'm going to be a co-pilot. And it was a big lumbering airplane, and what I wanted was a fast jet. So I was not very happy. I was suffering from a little PTSD at the end of my first tour because I lost a lot of friends during the war. And I was not doing very well in B-52 training, but I stuck it out, went through training, was at the squadron, and I decided, you know, I really don't want to be in a B-52 any longer. So I volunteered to go back to Vietnam if they would give me a fighter. And so I volunteered for a second tour, and I got a call from the assignment section. I was on alert in B-52s at the time. They called me at the alert facility and said, we have an assignment for you for a fighter, but it's going to be assignment Vietnam. Are you sure you want this? I said, you bet. So they, right there on the phone, we worked out my assignment, where I was going to go to fighter lead-in training and where I was going to go through F4 training and water survival and all the things that I had to do to get back into what I wanted to get into. So they sent me to Homestead Air Force Base for F4 training. And I'll be honest with you, Mate, I was not a very good student in the F4. I still was suffering from PTSD, and I had some problems focusing. I'd just come off of a year and a half of flying the B-52, where I couldn't make any airborne decisions because I was just a co-pilot, and it was not a real good environment for me to get ready for F4 training. But there was a war going on, and they needed pilots in the war, so I muddled through the F4 training and went over to Ubon, Royal Thai Air Force Base. And it was a wonderful assignment. I got combat ready right before we started flying over North Vietnam.
Yeah, amazing. Talking about the PTSD, I interviewed Matt Howell and he had some PTSDs coming back from Afghanistan. What was the sign for you? When did you recognize you had some PTSDs?
I'll be honest with you. I recognized that I had PTSD about 3 years ago. I look back now at what I was like in 1970, and I could see that I had PTSD. We didn't even know such a term existed then, and nobody offered any treatment or anything. I got better by going back to war again. I think that's what helped me with my PTSD. I never got treatment for it, but as I progressed in my second tour in Vietnam flying F4s, my head got on straight. I went from being a really lousy F4 pilot to being a fairly competent F-4 pilot. And I was in the flight lead upgrade program, and I was able to project ahead of the airplane. And by the time I finished my tour, my year, I was at the point where I could think further ahead than the flight lead could. I would be thinking, we ought to be switching to this channel now, and this, they're using this many munitions. And I would be thinking ahead of my flight lead. So I knew that my brain was coming back. I was able to start thinking like a fighter pilot.
Yeah. And what is a little bit of surprising is that you were assigned directly in Vietnam at that moment. It was not assignment back in the States. And then you were projected as a squadron. It was a direct assignment in Vietnam.
Yes. Well, actually, the flying was over Vietnam, but we were in Thailand. So the war ended every time we landed. It was totally different from being at Da Nang. At Da Nang, when you landed at Da Nang, you went from fighting the war in the air to fighting the war on the ground. They were shooting 122 millimeter rockets at us all the time. The war never ended. In Thailand, we would get shot at like crazy while we're flying over North Vietnam, but then we would land and the war is over. We could go downtown, we could go to restaurants, which of course we couldn't do at Da Nang. We could go to tailor shops and have clothing made. I mean, it was a nice life. In fact, my wife came over to Thailand and joined me while I was there for part of my tour. And it was just a wonderful existence. And I really enjoyed the flying.
Yeah, it should have been a bit strange. You are flying over at hostile territories, and then you have a part of your civilian life that comes to Thailand. And that's a bit strange for the brain just to switch from war missions to everyday family.
Right, absolutely. In fact, I rented a house downtown Ubon, and it was a walled compound. We had a wall around the house and a guard, and we had a housemaid. It was really, really neat. I would come back from, typically I'd get up at 2:30 in the morning for our launches over Hanoi. And we would launch as the sun came up, and I'd be done flying by noon. And I'd come back and just a relaxing time in Thailand. It was really quite different. One minute you're getting shot at with surface-to-air missiles and all kinds of AAA, and a couple hours later you're relaxing by the swimming pool.
Yeah, coming back on your F4 missions, I'm pretty sure you did a lot of air-to-ground missions, but can you tell us a bit about that?
Sure. Most of my flights, I would say 80% of my flights, were air-to-ground carrying smart bombs. Now, back in 1972, smart bombs are not like what they are now, but still, they were precision-guided munitions, and we would have someone with a laser designator designate the target. Now, that might be the flight lead with a designator pod on his aircraft, or it might be a FAC who had laser-designated equipment. And the laser-guided bombs, LGBs, were just incredible. I mean, they were so accurate. Not as accurate as today's terminally guided munitions, but really, it was a game changer. Then the other 20%, I would say, were just dumb bombs, Mark 82s or Mark 83s. Those are 500 pounders or 750 pounders. And that's what I started out using when I first got to Ubon, because the Battle of An Lach was going on. And so we were flying three missions. It was a triple turn. The first few missions I flew, we would fly from Ubon, drop the bombs at An Lach. That's where the North Vietnamese were trying to infiltrate into the South. There was a huge battle going on. We would land at Ben Hoa, and while they're refueling and reloading our airplane, we'd get a bite to eat, take off again, and drop our bombs at An Lach, go back to Ben Hoa, refuel and reload, and then go to somewhere in Laos and hit a target with a FAC. I did that for 3 days, and I had 9 missions in the first 3 days.
Did you use napalm? Because we always think about napalm as a badass weapon, but did you use it at that moment?
The only time I dropped napalm was at An Lach. That's right. It was a troops in contact situation, and I had two missions that I recall where I dropped napalm. And of course, you know, when you drop napalm, it's a low angle delivery. So you're subject to a lot more hostile fire for a longer period of time when you're on your bomb mm-hmm. delivery. But I only did that twice that I can recall.
And have you been shut down? And I'm sure a lot of your friends have been shut down.
Well, during my first tour, I was flying over Laos. And it's totally different war over Laos than it is over South or North Vietnam. Over South and North Vietnam, if you're shot down, you're either rescued or you're captured. And if you're captured, you end up on a very, very arduous journey up to North Vietnam and go to what we call the Hanoi Hilton, the Hoa Lo prison. But yeah. Over Laos, almost no one who was shot down over Laos, if they were not rescued, almost no one went to North Vietnam prison camps. They were murdered by the Pathet Lao. It was a very brutal place to fly. And I lost a lot of friends flying over Laos. And I was really worried because we would hear stories about, you know, when teams would be inserted to recover the human remains, it was not pretty. It was a totally different environment flying over Laos than it was flying over North Vietnam. So I was shot at a lot. In fact, most, I'll say 70% of my O2A missions were flown at night. And the reason for that is we had this, it was new at the time, it was called a Starlight Scope, which was a night vision device. We didn't have night vision goggles like we have now, but it was a night vision telescope that we would use to look at the Ho Chi Minh Trail at night, and we could see if there are trucks moving along the trail. So at night, you can see the tracers coming up at you, and it's just like I have flashbacks every 4th of July because it was like what you see for the fireworks displays in the United States on the 4th of July. It was like that over the Ho Chi Minh Trail virtually every night. In the daytime, we got fired. We got shot at also, but you couldn't see the tracers as much. And I don't think they shot as much in the daytime as they did at night. So I took a lot of ground fire during my first tour. And I have to tell you, God was watching over me the entire time. I never took a hit, never one scratch on my airplane. During the F-4 flying, over North Vietnam, there was an awful lot of AAA, of course, 23, 37, 57, 85. But the thing that I was the most concerned about, even more than MiGs, was the SAMs, SA-2s. And I had some very close calls with SA-2s, but again, never took a hit. One time, we were egressing the target north of Hanoi, near Kep Airfield. We were egressing the target, and we saw a missile coming up at us from our left 7 o'clock. And it was different from the normal SA-2 missile. The SA-2 typically is lead pursuit, where the missile heads out in front of you to meet wherever you are, and it's not that difficult to defeat. This was doing what I call lag pursuit, where it was pointed right at the tails of our airplanes. So we separated into two ships to see which of us was the target. And it was my two ship that was the target. I was the wingman. and I could see this missile coming right at us as we go down. It follows us down and it's just coming right at us. And as I saw the missile right behind my airplane in my rearview mirror, there are three rearview mirrors in the F-4. When I saw the missile, I broke hard left. And because I figured it was going to get either one of us or both of us, and it got my flight lead. It didn't get me. And he did not get shot down. His airplane was pissing fuel and hydraulic fluid like crazy, but he was still flying. So I escorted him back to Da Nang, and I looked over my aircraft very carefully because I could hear the explosion. I could feel the explosion, but there was not a scratch on my airplane. It was just amazing. And he, you know, I escorted him to Da Nang and he had a successful barrier engagement landing. So everything worked out fine.
When you've been shot at, was it a bit of fear or did you have all that muscle memory rebuilt during the entire training, the entire fighter pilot training, that helps you during that kind of moment?
You know, it's funny that you should ask that. The first time I got shot at was on a night flight, my first night flight over the Ho Chi Minh Trail. I was in the right seat of the O2 with the Starlight scope, and I had what's called a CTIP, Combat Tactics Instructor Pilot, in the left seat. And he was showing me the remote control switch for a ground fire. You turn on your external lights and all the ground, you start seeing sparkles all over the ground where people are shooting at you. And I'm using the Starlight scope and I'm looking around and I see two white lights coming. They're kind of stationary, very close to below the airplane, two white lights, and they're stationary, not moving much, but they're kind of getting brighter and moving a little further apart. And I said to him, I said, I got two lights on the ground here, but they're moving slightly apart. And he says, no, it's AAA. And he banks the airplane hard left. And just as he banks hard left, I see those tracers go by the right wingtip, and I could hear them as they went by because the window's open, and the O2, we flew with the window open, and I could smell the cordite. And I remember thinking, why are they trying to shoot at me? I'm this nice guy. What do they have against me? Why are they trying to shoot at me? So that's what was going through my mind the first time I got shot at.
And then after the North Vietnam War, you came back to the States. Did you stay in the Air Force or did you move directly in the civilian world?
Well, I was assigned for my next assignment to Okinawa. I was assigned to fly F-4s in the 18th TAC Fighter Wing in Okinawa. And this is really funny. I envisioned that I'd be in Okinawa flying training missions or pulling alert or something like that. When I got to the base, Kadena Air Base in Okinawa, nobody was at the squadron. There was one sergeant at the squadron, and he told me that everybody in the squadron was TDY to CCK Air Base in Taiwan, and they were going to be TDY forever. So he said, you can process into the base, get all your paperwork done, and then you have to go over to CCK Air Base. And the way it worked was we would go over to CCK and every 90 days or so come back to Okinawa to touch base for a weekend or something and then start another 90-day tour at CCK. It was terrible on people who had children, you know, because a lot of people had kids in school and they're never home. It was very, very tough on the married guys who had families. I went over there and got checked out, and I will tell you, there's a famous expression that I'm sure you've heard, and it is there's two bad things that can happen to a fighter pilot. One is he takes off knowing it's his last flight in a fighter, and the other is he takes off not knowing it's his last flight in a fighter. And that happened to me. I was on a gunnery range mission, and I wasn't feeling very well. And in fact, during the pitch out, coming in to land, during the break, I started blacking out. I had to give the airplane to my backseater. And I just was not feeling well. And after we landed, I couldn't even climb out of the airplane by myself. And the medics were called, and they took me out of the seat and rushed me to the hospital. And it turned out I had a really bad case of mononucleosis. And so I was grounded for about 3 months. And right around that time, after I got out of the hospital and I was doing some ground duty at the squadron, there was a call came into the squadron that they needed somebody to go to the wing headquarters for a desk job. So I was the guy who was still grounded, and they said, okay, you're going to wing headquarters. So I ended up not getting a champagne flight in the F-4 because the people at wing headquarters in the desk jobs did not fly the aircraft. They flew other airplanes, the T-39. But I didn't get a final flight in the F-4. So that was, in fact, the anniversary of that is coming up. It's on July 5th was my last flight in the F-4 in 1973. So, you know, it was bittersweet. I enjoyed flying the T-39. We would carry generals and congressmen all over the Pacific. And it was like a mini airline job. It was really cool. And, of course, I had I had a desk job where I had to do paperwork, and it turned out I was a pretty good staff officer. I found out that I enjoyed that. So I didn't mind that much. I did that for 3 years. And after that, I was assigned to Patrick Air Force Base in Florida as an O2A instructor pilot. Patrick Air Force Base is a wonderful location. It's right near Cape Kennedy. And we could see the missiles going up, you know, every time they do something, you know, send somebody up into space, we could see take off. It was a really nice assignment, but we had a really, really terrible squadron commander. Morale was terrible. And after a while, I decided I wanted to leave the Air Force. In March 10th of 1978, I was really fed up. I went to this squadron at Patrick Air Force Base in 1976. And like I said, we had just a terrible squadron commander, and a lot of guys were getting out of the Air Force, and I decided I was going to get out. And I got out on March 10th, and I went to a private flight engineer school in Denver to get my flight engineer rating. And I applied to all the airlines, and I was 33 years old. You know, back in 1978, 33 was considered the over the hill if you wanted to get a job with an airline. I could not get any airlines to even talk to me. But finally, United Airlines called me in for an interview, and I got hired by United Airlines. So I was really fortunate. I got hired in October of 1978, October 16th, and I went through training as a flight engineer. Well, I was already trained as a flight engineer, so I did really well in training. In fact, I did so well in training that I was invited to stay on at United as an instructor. So I stayed at Denver at the United Airlines Training Center as an instructor for the next year, teaching other flight engineers how to be flight engineers and teaching ground school. So I did that for a year. And then I went out to San Francisco to be a 727 flight engineer. And about then, the airline was losing money like crazy, and things were looking bad, kind of like the way they look right now. And finally, I got my furlough notice, and I was furloughed. Actually, my official last day at the airline was April Fool's Day, April 1st, 1981. I had been downgraded to flight engineer on the 737. Which is a position that doesn't even exist. You just sit in the dump seat and you look for traffic and you operate a few switches on the overhead panel. But my duties on my last flight were to listen to the ADF because President Reagan had just been shot. And I had to give reports to the passengers over the PA system on how President Reagan was doing. And then on April 1st, and it was shortly after midnight that we landed, I turned in my ID, I turned in my cockpit key, I turned in my manuals to an empty office, just they had a place for me to put them, and I drove home and cried all the way home. And I thought, this is the end of my career, this is the end of my life. Well, I got to tell you, Monte, it was one of the best things to happen to me. I didn't get a really good job right away. I worked for Lockheed for several months in a ground position, which I just really did not like. And then I heard that the Air Force was looking for people to come back on active duty. So I applied, and 246 people applied for to come back on active duty, and 13 of us were accepted. So I went back on active duty, and they sent me to Patrick Air Force Base to be an instructor in O2s again. So I did that for a couple of years. And When I was talking to the assignments people, I told them I wanted to go to Yokota Air Base flying T-39s, and they made it happen. So my next assignment was going to Yokota Air Base flying T-39s, and had the same mission I had at Kadena, flying generals and congressmen all over the Pacific. And then we upgraded to the Learjet, which was a wonderful airplane. The C-21 is a Lear 35, and We could fly twice as far unrefueled as we could in the T-39, and we could go a lot faster. We could get up to altitude twice in half the time. So it was a wonderful airplane, and I got to go to some really neat places. I flew the first Learjet to ever go into Beijing. I flew that with Ambassador Rowney as my passenger. And so I was very fortunate. And I was the operations officer of the squadron. And then I became the squadron commander toward the end of my time at Yokota.
Yeah, awesome. Didn't you feel a bit like a jump in the past coming back in active duty?
Well, I really enjoyed it because when I was back at Patrick Air Force Base the second time, we had a great squadron commander, a great series of squadron commanders. And so, and morale was a lot better. It was a different Air Force. I was gone for 4 years, but it was a different Air Force when I went back. So here I was at the end of my tour at Yokota Air Base, and United had recalled me. And United said, if you don't come back when your overseas tour is over, we're going to remove you from our seniority list. So here I had 16 and a half years active duty. You need 20 years to get an Air Force retirement. I had 16 and a half years active duty, and it was a tough choice. But finally I said, you know, I'm going to go back to the airline. So I went back to United, and I was a 737 co-pilot. And then I became a 737 instructor a year later. And then I became a 727 captain, and then a 727 standards captain, which is a check pilot. And yeah. I did that for several years. In fact, half of my career at United was at the training center in one capacity or another. You know, I'd be at the training center for a few years, and then I'd go out and fly the line for a few years. And finally, in 1999, I got a bid to the 777, and I flew my very first overwater international flight on the anniversary of my new hire date, October 16th, 1999. So I loved the 777, and I was flying that mostly from New York to London, and then London to Chicago, and then Chicago back to London. And then finally, we picked up New York to Tokyo trips, and then we would fly from Tokyo to Seoul or from Tokyo to someplace else. Like we didn't go to Hong Kong, but we went from Narita to Singapore. So those were six-day trips, and I really enjoyed it.
So you've done all your time in United, and in the early 2000s, you decided to retire from United?
Well, I didn't decide to retire. I was forced out kicking and screaming. I had the audacity to turn age 60, and the rule then was age 60 and you have to leave, and I really didn't want to leave. I was at the top of my game. I was an evaluator on the 777. I was flying. I would do 1 month at the training center as an evaluator and one month on the line flying line trips. It was a wonderful assignment. And I turned 60 and they said, there's the door. Adios. So I was not very happy. And 2 months after I retired, United Airlines terminated the pilot pension. So what I had been planning on for an income for the rest of my life was over. So it was a tough time. I did some teaching at Metropolitan State University. It was called Metropolitan State College of Denver at the time, and Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. I did teaching there, and I finally got a job at Flight Safety International in Orlando. So my wife and I moved to Orlando, and I was teaching on the Citation Sovereign. And I was in the simulator one night in February of 2007, and I had forgotten to turn my cell phone off. And my cell phone rang, and we were on a vector, so I answered it. And it was a recruiter from Aero Personnel in Canada. And she said, do you still want to be a 777 captain in India? And I said, I never applied for this. I never left anything in India. Why are you calling me? She says, we desperately need 100 captains. So I said, well, I'm in the middle of a simulator period. Send me an email. So I went home after the simulator period, and I was checking my email. It was about midnight at this time. And my wife wanted to have a heart-to-heart conversation with me about where are we going financially, because the flight safety wasn't paying anything like what I was making as an airline pilot. And we didn't have a house anymore. We were renting a condo in Florida. And I said, how about if I go to India for $12,000 a month tax-free? And she said, have a nice trip.
It is allowed in the States just to be forced to retire a pilot, then to move his pension?
Well, it was the law. Age 60 in the United States was mandatory retirement age.
Come on, they force you to retire and they just cut off your pension. This is just insane.
That's right. It should be illegal, but it wasn't because United Airlines at the time was in bankruptcy. So basically, they could do whatever they wanted. Here I was 63 years old, too old to legally fly in the United States. And I was flying, I was in command of these, of a 777 Jet Airways aircraft landing at Newark. It was such a good feeling.
Yeah, I can just easily imagine. How was your expat life in India?
Well, they put us at great hotels. They would give us a positive space. It was 3 weeks on, 1 week off. So for 3 weeks, we're at hotels in India, luxury hotels, because anything other than a luxury hotel is dangerous to live in. I'm just, it's really, really very austere in India. But mm-hmm. we would be in a luxury hotel 3 weeks where we would, you know, stay between our flying assignments. And we had a positive space transportation back home. It was a 30-hour commute for me from Mumbai to Castle Rock, Colorado. And I'd be home for a week, and I wouldn't feel so great for the first 5 days. You know, it took at least 5 days for me to recover. And about the time I'm a normal human being again, it was time for me to go back to work. So it was a tough commute, but the flying was wonderful. The flight attendants were very professional, and they treated us like gold. They loved the expat pilot. We treated them much, much better than the Indian pilots did. It's a cultural thing. The Indian pilots all have servants at home, and they would treat the flight attendants like they would treat their servants. Not mm-hmm. bad, but just not as respectfully as we did. And the flight attendants just loved us. So it was really great flying. And then we started picking up San Francisco to Shanghai routes. So I would get positive space ticket from Colorado to San Francisco, get a hotel room in San Francisco, and then we'd have four pilots, all captains, flying from San Francisco to Shanghai. And then we would have five-day layovers in Shanghai. So it was really, it was basically because Jet Airways hadn't figured out how to give us three-day layovers like every other airline does. So we have five-day layovers in the greatest shopping city in the world. So it was a good tour of duty as an expat. But Jet Airways was losing money, Mate, and they finally outsourced us to other airlines. Some of the guys went to fly for Turkish Airlines, and I went to Bahrain to fly for Gulf Air. So we were outsourced to Gulf Air. The airplanes were repainted in Gulf Air colors, and I would operate as a captain, as an aircraft commander on a Gulf Air flight. And we had some great flights there. We went from Bahrain to Riyadh, to Dubai, to Kuala Lumpur, to Manila, flew a lot of the places you're flying now, flew over Vietnam, and I could look up and see Da Nang off in the distance. It was kind of fun to do that.
And then what do you do now? Are you still instructing on the 777 and 787?
No. As I was approaching age 75, and that's the age limit in India, as I was approaching age 75, Jet Airways finally got rid of all of their expat pilots. They had their own pilot force, and they were all fully qualified on the 777 by that time. And they were not too happy about having us there, and I don't blame them. So they got rid of the expats in 2009, and I became an airline safety auditor. I would go all over the world, starting in 2010. I would go all over the world with a team of auditors, and we would do what's called IOSA audits. That's the IATA operational safety audits. We would look at every aspect of the airline's operation. It would be five auditors for 5 days, and we would look at 1,000 different things on our checklist and write a report. So I did that for a couple of years. Then I was invited to be a 787 instructor at Boeing. So I jumped ship and went over to Boeing as a 787 instructor. I did that in the simulator, and then I started instructing 777s also. And then there's an airline called, a supplemental carrier called Omni Air International. They were operating using the simulators here in Denver. So I wasn't so crazy about going out to Seattle to do simulator training all the time. I got a job with Omni as a contract instructor. So I was teaching for Omni on the 777 in Denver, and I was teaching for Boeing on the 787 in Seattle, and then eventually Miami. So I did that for a couple of years, and those jobs all ended at some point. And now I am back teaching as a lecturer 2 days a week at Metropolitan State University of Denver. And just a year ago, I was hired by United Airlines to be a ground school instructor on the 737. So that's where I am now. I'm doing that. Although right now I'm stuck at home because of this COVID thing. So I haven't been to work for a couple months now because I'm in the high risk group and they say I have to stay home until it's less threat. So that's where I am right now.
I know you've done some books writings. Can you talk a little bit about that, especially the Ham Fist novel series?
Well, thank you very much for asking. I had been mentally writing my first book for over 40 years. It was just gnawing at me. I wanted to write about my experiences in Vietnam. And I didn't want to write a memoir where I would use real names, because out of respect to all of my friends who were killed, I didn't want to use their real names. So instead, I decided to make it a novel series, a fictionalized memoir. So I created this character, Hamilton Hancock, who picks up the name Hamfist, and basically 70 to 80% of the story is things that happened to me during my first and second tour in Vietnam. But I make myself a whole lot more heroic than I was in real life. But it's a fun read. It's based on real stories. Most of these things happened to me, although some of the stories are things that happened to my friends in combat, but 90% of the stories are totally true. Now I have four books in the series. The first is called Ham Fist Over the Trail. The second one is called Ham Fist Down, because at the end of the first book, he gets shot down in Laos. Mm-hmm. The third book is called Ham Fist Over Hanoi. That's where he's flying F-4s. The fourth book is called Ham Fist Out. And that's where at the end of the book, he gets out of the Air Force. So that's as far as the series has gone so far.
I know you have some real books, and you have some audiobooks as well.
You know, I just completed the audio version of Ham Fist Over the Trail. And I had my son, who's a media professional, help me with this. And the book runs about 5 hours, but the audiobook, but it took 5 days to do that because every single sentence had to be re-recorded over and over again until my son, the perfectionist, was happy. And he did a fantastic job as a director and an editor, editing the audio. So it came out really well. I'm very pleased with that book. And it's called Ham Fist Over the Trail, and it's available, of course, on Audible. In fact, you know, if you go to a website we created called freehamfist.com. If you go to freehamfist.com, you can get that audiobook for free if you sign up for an account with Audible. So that's a really neat way to get the book for free. And then if you have an account with Audible, you can get a book for free every month, basically.
And George, I know you have as well a podcast. It's called the Ready for Takeoff podcast.
Yes, my son talked me into this, and I'm in my fifth year now. He said, Dad, you ought to do a podcast. So I thought, well, I'll give it a try. So I launched it. And like I said, I'm in my fifth year. I'm over 400 episodes now. And it's been a really neat journey because I get to interview some really incredible people like yourself, people with amazing stories to tell. And every Monday, I have an episode where I have an interview with someone with an amazing story to tell. And then on Thursdays, I have some other kind of short episode where it's typically educational, where I'll talk about something that might help someone who's just learning aviation. So I have 2 episodes a week, and I have 1,000 downloads a day now. So it's growing, and it's doing well.
I just enjoy it and listen it a lot. Do you have any major lessons learned from your military and commercial pilot career?
I would say, in my opinion, and I've been an instructor pilot for over 40 years, the thing that impresses me the most about other pilots that I fly with when I see it is pilots who can recover from adversity. Because so many times you see someone, when I would be administering a check ride or something, where someone would really not do well on their first approach. And it's the way they handle adversity after that that will either impress me of them being great pilots or just not so great. The ones that beat themselves up all the time and say, oh, I did so badly on that. And you can hear them talking to themselves over the hot mic. You can hear them saying, I wish I hadn't done that, while they're getting ready for the next approach. Or there are the pilots who just say, well, this is the first minute of the rest of this flight. I'm going to make this work. And they forget about how they did badly, and they do well from that point on. So that's the most important part of flying to me, is being able to compartmentalize and to deal with what happens on every flight. There's no perfect flight. I have never had a perfect flight yet. So when you make mistakes, life goes on, and you just do the best you can from that point on.
Yeah, and this is the way all the students have to be taught, because you will have serious failures during your career, and you will have just to know how to handle with, and you will do major mistakes during your career, and you will just have to handle with it. This is something very important. And in the selection process of the French Air Force and in the teaching process of the French Air Force, we just have a look on that, because the trainees, they always do mistakes, and sometimes major mistakes. And we just want to see how they cope with that. If they just give up and say, okay, you have controls, I did a mistake and blah, blah, blah. Okay, this is not good. And they should be terminated in a couple of flights, because this is not the way we want a pilot, and especially a fighter pilot, to just react.
That's absolutely right. And you would not believe how many of my guests, I'm not going to mention their names, but you will hear it in the interviews I've had, some very famous aviators who failed rides during their training. And the thing that impressed me the most was how they bounced back. They didn't give up.
Yeah, exactly. George, what's next in your aviation bucket list, as you always ask?
Well, this is amazing. I had a reservation to go to Florida and fly a P-51. I had an appointment to do that in March, and the COVID hit and I couldn't travel. So I had to cancel that. And at some point after this COVID is over, when I can travel again, I'm going to go to Florida and fly the P-51. And that's on my aviation bucket list.
And that's awesome. Do you want to add anything, George?
No, I think that's it. It's been a real pleasure talking to you, Mate. Thank you so much for your courtesy of hosting me.
Yeah, thank you very much for joining me on the 90s podcast. It was a real pleasure and honor having you, and your journey in the Air Force, I think, was amazing.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You've been listening to the 90s podcast, an aviation podcast. You can find George's podcast, the Ready for Takeoff podcast, on all conventional platforms. You can find his novel series, the Hamfist novel series, on Amazon. Now, if you liked this show, subscribe and share. You can as well follow us, the 90s podcast website, Instagram, and Facebook account. Thanks again for listening.